What's up, Zach? How you doing, man?
Good, Joe. How are you doing?
Fantastic. So I think the last time I saw you, we're in Sydney, which is where you're based, but you're also American. So
It's true.
it's true. Yes.
But I've been here 19 years. I've got four little Australians. They also have US passports, but when I tell them they're American too, they look at me funny.
That's funny. Awesome. For people who don't know who you are, do you want to give a quick intro?
Sure. My name is Zachary Zeus. I'm the CEO of two companies, BizCubed, which is a data engineering firm. We've been doing data engineering work for a long time, since before data engineering was sort of the a known phrase. And then I also am the CEO of a startup called Pix Global. The two companies, sort of the way we think about it, are two sides of the data coin. On the one side, BizCubed is really focused on helping organizations get their data house in order. So focusing on the data engineering operations, how do you build data capability at scale? And Pix Global is really sort of how do you leverage the data that your organization is creating and managing and developing to build and develop and maintain competitive differentiation in the marketplace. And so basically, BizCubes, get your data house in order, and Pix is how do you take advantage of that data to grow your market, grow your profitability.
Interesting. What's it like running two companies?
Well, it can be a little bit schizophrenic because a established organization with patterns and robust capability is very different than a startup where you're kind of putting your hands on everything. You kind of have two very different kinds of jobs. But ultimately, it comes down to working with the teams that you have around you and helping them be more effective day in and day out. And so at BizCubed, actually, we've just promoted. I've run BizCubed with my wife for quite a while, but we've promoted her to be co-CEO with me. And so I maintain sort of strategic responsibilities, but she does all the day-to-day stuff. And so that means that from a day-to-day perspective, I don't need to get too involved in BizCube. So I can focus on the startup where, like I said, hands are on all the tools.
Makes a lot of sense. Good for your wife for doing that. I don't think a lot of spouses do it. So I'm gonna go run a company with you.
No, it's. We do have a unique relationship. Mostly it works. Sometimes it doesn't. But usually, when it doesn't, we try to keep that behind closed doors. We try
That's a
not
good
to.
idea. Yelling in front of the employees. It's always a good look. So
Well, and actually, when we first started working together, there was a little bit that happened sometimes. But now, not. Like we've evolved sort of the working relationship and the personal relationship, so we have some clean separation between those things.
that helps a ton. That's awesome. Good for you, man. Figure that out. You win a Nobel Prize, I think. So,
The Nobel Peace Prize for marital relationships, right?
It is a real thing. We'll push for this. And I remember we met a couple years ago in Sydney, and we're on a rainy hike around the zoo somewhere. I can't remember exactly where it was,
Yeah,
but it was
so
a lot of fun.
Bradley's Head. Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the world.
Beautiful. Stunning. I'd say one of those beautiful places I visited so far. We're talking about trust architectures, which I thought was an interesting concept. I was utterly clueless about this, and I think you would have started kind of formulating some ideas around this concept. Walk me and the audience through trust architecture. I think this is something that the last couple of times we've hung out, you've been just brimming with excitement about it, and I think it's a pretty cool topic. So.
Yeah, so it is something, and it's not surprising that it was a new phrase for you. It was a new phrase for us too. It's something that we're really pioneering conceptually. and this is really the focus of the startup, which is Pix Global. And the idea there is that I said sort of Pix's job is how do organizations build their competitive differentiation in the marketplace? And so how does a organization demonstrate the value of the good of the goods and services that they produce beyond just the product features? And so the key thing that's happening globally right now is an increased focus on primarily carbon. But as people are starting to think about how you track carbon through supply chains to manage scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3 emissions, people are also going, well, if we can do this for carbon, why can't we do this for our social expectations, our governance expectations, other environmental considerations beyond just carbon? And what we're seeing internationally is real significant regulation coming into place around the world. We're seeing boards of sort of the big companies that we all sort of recognize their brands of committing to sort of driving carbon out of their supply chain, as well as increasing their social and governance and environmental impact across their entire supply chain portfolio. And so what this is creating is a significant challenge, right? Because there are no consistent standards around carbon. There are no consistent standards around social governance, social expectations. There's no standards around governance. We have expectations, but how we meet those expectations are going to be different in every organization. They're going to be different in every country. They're going to be different in every community. And so the challenge we see is how do you reflect those differences in a consistent way so that our companies, our communities, our organizations can take advantage of or outcompete in this changing world. And our view is that that takes a new kind of capability that we're describing as trust architecture. And what we're doing is we're linking the great work that an organization does from a ESG perspective to the products that they're selling. And so if you think about sort of your phone, it has thousands of components from hundreds of suppliers. And if you sort of walk back into the critical minerals, the metals, the plastic, the glass that goes into that, there's a very, very complex supply chain behind that. And what a trust architecture allows you to do is ask your suppliers to share information in a consistent way so that you can share with your customers the robustness of the components that you've put into your products. And ultimately what this turns into is nowhere to hide for poor or bad behavior in the global marketplace.
Interesting. And let me play devil's advocate for a sec. I think ESG was a interesting and popular topic. Let me see if I look at Google Trends. When was the peak of that? Probably March of 2023. And it's kind of gone down since then. And then obviously with a U.S. election, who the hell knows what's going to be happening with the popularity or lack thereof of ESG. But wait, how do you, I think with the downturn, ESG initiatives have sort of been taken to the back burner for a lot of companies. Like, at least in the U.S., I mean, this is at least the popular trope in a lot of business journalism, like CNBC and Wall Street Journal. Like, how do you incentivize companies to want to adopt this type of trust architecture where they're accountable to ESG when there's really no motivating force to be held accountable to it?
Well, so, yeah, I, sort of take your point sort of in the US, there are incentives globally. So for example, in Europe, there's something called a carbon border adjustment mechanism. Basically it's a carbon tax on importers who want to sell their products in the European Union. And what the process is you, when you import your goods into Europe, they'll assess the carbon impact of your goods to their standards, mm-hmm. and they will charge a tax on your goods so for you to import them. And politically, this is very popular, right? Because people are sort of concerned about climate change. They are concerned about sort of the carbon load around the world. And what this does is it moves the burden from the populace, from the people of Europe, to the people importing the goods into Europe, right? So it's a tax on foreign companies to address Europeans' needs for or Europeans' desires to work to address the climate crisis. So that's one example of places where there are incentives. And so where what industry is asking the European Union is, how do we prove to you that we should not be charged a tariff because we've done the right thing from a carbon perspective? And a trust architecture and the UN transparency protocol that we're sort of building out is a technique that people are pointing at as a way of doing that.
And what's this UN thing that you're trying to do? I think you sent me a link on this. Is it recommendation 49, is it? Or what is it?
Yeah, so recommendation 49 is the UN transparency protocol. So it's transparency at scale. It's sort of, how do you create a consistent way of sharing data so that across your supply chain, so that there's nowhere to hide for unsustainable behavior. And there's been a lot of, you sort of talked about sort of hype and trends, and there's been a lot of hype around sort of supply chain traceability in the blockchain space.
Yeah.
That
was always a holy grail. Like, this is like blockchain, let's bring it to the real world and track inventory, right?
And our view is a blockchain. So the blockchain sort of created this idea that, hey, we can track goods from origin, right? Like this, and there's this Nirvana idea. But the challenge is the challenge every sort of blockchain implementation faced is, it's kind of like saying, we can achieve this outcome as long as we all put our data into one ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And you can easily get to the point where you go, all right, well, you can imagine if it was a Western ecosystem, like a US or maybe Europe, PN1 that everybody was starting to use, well, then Asia is probably not going to use that, and vice versa. And as soon as you have more than one, you realize that the interoperability between systems becomes the critical piece. And once you start, and so what the UN Transparency Protocol is focused on is that interoperability between disparate systems.
Yeah.
To create that sort of supply chain picture. And so the conceptual model we sort of say, we sort of use to help people wrap their head around this is saying that we all need to put our data into one ecosystem in order to have traceability is similar to saying, hey, we can pay each other as long as we're all part of the same bank. And we all know that there are thousands of banks, and there is data interoperability between those banks, because it's not like people are sending cash around when we pay each other. It's a data transaction, right? Like a purely data transaction. And so that data interoperability is possible. It's just, we need to drive down the cost of doing that and make it really decentralized, so you don't have to wire up thousands of APIs just to understand your supply chain. We actually need to tie it to the actual transactions, mm-hmm. because we're already doing data exchange for every transaction that exists across the global supply chain.
Yeah. Right?
So when I sell you a product, there's a data transfer of money moving from your account to my account. And so we're sort of expanding that conceptual model to include information about the product, right? As well as information about where the product was made, information about the carbon load of that product, and. So you just sort of extend out the conceptual model to all sorts of other bits of information. And our sort of key insight or key recommendation is you're only going to share data with your customers if it has value, right? So if my customer says, hey, I'd like to know the carbon load of the box of rocks you just sold me, and I'm going to say to you, well, it cost me money to track the carbon load of my box of rocks. So are you willing to pay a premium on the product if I share that data with you? The answer might be no, in which case I'm going to say, well, I can appreciate you want that, but too bad, too sad, off you go.
Yeah.
But if it is valuable to my customer to share that data, then I will share it. And increasingly so that's where we see that sort of alignment of incentives and activation of the marketplace that protocol is designed to activate the marketplace to respond to these opportunities that exist and to sort of align the activities around sort of solving these problems.
Interesting. And so when you're talking about supply chain, do you expect this trust architecture is going to trace all the way back to raw materials for components?
Yes.
Okay.
So one of the other UN projects we're working on is a critical minerals project, which is a starting point. And so one of the things that we've realized, well, it's kind of obvious when you say it, but everything that we consume is either mined or grown,
mm-hmm.
right? So minerals and agriculture are sort of the starting points of pretty much everything that we have in our houses, in our homes, in our day-to-day lives. And so we're running pilots as we speak in minerals and agriculture.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the amount of carbon that goes into making stuff like ammonia fertilizers, for example, is insane.
Yep.
Actually.
Yeah.
Like people realize like that's mainly a fossil fuel product.
Yeah. 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 So ethanol in gas, right? Like there's this sort of green gas idea, but because of the carbon load of the fertilizers that go into that ethanol, not really that. It's not that green, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's all sorts of problems with that. Anyway, part of the challenge, Joe, and one of the things we don't want to be doing is sort of putting our values onto this ecosystem, right? Like I might make personal choices, but really we need to build a protocol that supports the sort of actual realities of the marketplace. And so the protocol is a way of exchanging data so that we can provide transparency and traceability all the way to raw materials and all the way to the agricultural products that go into them, or all the way to the base levels. But activating the ability for folks to make their own marketplace decisions about the credentials that go along with that.
Well, for sure. I mean, it's a classic argument that a lot of developing countries have about the West, you know, and or the complaint really is like, you guys caused a lot of this mess to begin with, i.e. the West did.
Yep.
With the carbonization, and then the developing world's expected to pitch in and help out with something that really wasn't their making at all, actually. So, and abide by the standards of the West, which is if you're in Bangladesh, like have fun with that. Even if you had a law, they're like, that's cool, I'm not going to do it. So, so it's good to kind of like, you know, but, and it seems like this would work really, and I'd like your take on this. It seems like the impetus for this is really going to take hold if you can get the adoption from big companies like Apple and Caterpillar and the big manufacturers, because their supply chains are vast.
And what we're seeing when we look at their sort of annual reports are their boards committing to these things. And so one of the things that we're, when you sort of say, well, ESG is kind of down a little bit, sort of popularity, and it's kind of peaked already. The reality is boards are committing to this. And when a board commits to the market in their annual report that they're going to do something, they actually kind of have to. Otherwise, if their stock goes down, they've misrepresented what their activities are in the marketplace. The other thing that's sort of happening there as a result of that is big organizations are looking to figure out how to manage this challenge in a more structured, more complete, more comprehensive way, and how to gain competitive advantage as a result of doing that. There's kind of two sides of this. And so I mentioned earlier the stick and the carrot, I think. The carrot is the sort of opportunity, like if our customers are starting to demand this and we can provide proof that we're doing something, doing the right thing, then there should be additional margin available for that. And so some of that will go to cover the costs. Some of it will collect because we're doing the right thing, right? Like we'll increase our margins. The stick side of this, though, is if I'm a board member committing to the marketplace that we're going to do something from an ESG perspective and our organizations don't, there's real risk to board members of penalties, right? So one of the downsides of being on a board is you can get in trouble if your governance practices or if your organization's not doing what they said they're going to do to the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, but I kind of wonder what, because I mean, how do you prevent greenwashing though, right? Because it seems like every board, you know, they say, oh, we definitely need to do ESG. We definitely need to do DEI as well, right? And now if you look at DEI initiatives, those are being thrown out the window. I mean, that was popular in 2020. Now it's like, yeah, never mind. You know, if you just look at a lot of companies, they're simply not doing it like they said they were. So like, but you know, every company, I mean, no company in the world is going to say, well, there's probably a couple actually, but most of them are not going to say, I really want to do harm to the environment and make the environment far worse than it was. But at the same time, you know, if you look at decarbonization efforts around the world, last time I read that the needle hasn't moved in terms of the amount of carbon. Like, how do you incentivize companies to actually do this for real and not just pander to it?
Yeah. So basically in the UN Transparency Protocol, it is squarely targeted at eliminating greenwashing. And the way we're doing that is through sort of the verification models that sit underneath it. So it's not just I say to the market that I'm doing this. It's I'm proving to my customers that I have done it. And so it's that verification that becomes important, right? And so and we go back to the European Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. If I'm a tariff agent for the European Union border control, and I'm a big company importing a ton of cars, and I say, I've got these cars don't have any carbon because I do all these things. The European border agent is going to say, prove it. And the auto manufacturer will either be able to prove it or they won't. And if they're able to prove it, then their products won't be charged the tariff. And so they will be more competitive in the European market because there will be, because ultimately the cost will get passed on to the consumer at the other side. Or they will be able to meet the carbon proofs, or they won't be able to. And the border agent is just going to say, all right, well, I'm just going to charge the carbon tariff at the full whack because you weren't able to prove it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see these kinds of – so that's one example of the kinds of demonstration of if you can prove it, then you can get – you have a competitive advantage or you have a market access advantage that you wouldn't have otherwise. And so that proof becomes the critical piece of the puzzle to combat that greenwashing activity. And it's not like it's going to happen overnight tomorrow. But as the marketplace starts to ask for proof, increasingly people will provide proof. And as that proof adds value to the goods you're selling, you'll add more proofs and you'll sort of create this virtuous cycle where verifiable claims about the ESG credentials of your products have value in the marketplace. and therefore you will continue to provide verifiable proof. And for products that don't have that verifiable proof, they'll lose market access, or they'll have decreased value in the marketplace, those organizations will lose competitiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like that's going to have to be what it takes. I know that when was the last big accord for decarbonization, the 2050, whatever it was, and.
Oh, so the Kyoto and COP
23
and all those things.
Yeah, and it was nice. It was a nice gesture. It was cute, but it had no teeth to it. And like, it's just like, great, everyone's on board with this. And you notice that every country has like their initiatives sort of end in zero for some reason. It's always a round number for some reason. Like, oh, we'll be here by 2040 for sure. And it's just like. You know, at the same time, electric vehicle sales have gone down. I mean, at least in the U.S., some car manufacturers are getting out of the U.S. market for electric vehicles. So it's an interesting dilemma. But it feels like there's a lot of intent to want to do this stuff, but not a lot of consequences if you don't. So people are like, well, I got to hit my quarterly number. And that's kind of what matters to me right now.
Yeah. And so that's where this verifiability and market access and increased value really becomes the sort of both carrot and stick in this ecosystem. And ultimately, our view is if it's all regulatory and bureaucrats sitting in Europe waving their hands,
which they do a lot of.
That's their main job.
It is. Let's be fair. I mean, it is what they do.
Yeah. That's not actually going to achieve anything. And really, if we can sort of start baking verifiability into just the everyday transactions of trade, that really becomes a pretty big lever for the folks who are already doing this stuff, because the reality is there are organizations that are already doing more than they need to. The question is, are they getting the market advantage as a result? And if we can help them provide that verifiability, and by providing that verifiability, they outcompete in the market, as the marketplace is responding, the marketplace will respond faster, and we get the power of the market to drive the change we want. The change that, I mean, from a carbon perspective, the change that the scientists are telling us we absolutely need to see. And so, my view on that is, we start getting that market shift, things can move much, much faster.
Yep.
Than the bureaucrats can make happen. Where are those leverage points that we can use to sort of create those shifts? And that's what we're exploring, and that's what PIX Global is all about. And so
that's cool.
back to the trust architecture question, we actually see that there's a new job, which is a trust architect, whose job it is to build these trust architectures to allow organizations to outcompete on these kinds of verifiable proofs of the good work that they're doing. The challenge that we see is that every organization is going to need a trust architecture where they take the inputs, the things that they buy from their suppliers, they do their business, which is build something maybe, build a product, build a phone, build a chair, whatever it is, and then attach the appropriate level of proof of their great work to the product that they're selling so that they can get additional market access or a higher premium or target a unique niche in the market. And that sort of activity of mapping sort of goods coming in to products going out is a company level trust architecture. And we're going to need trust architects to help them do that, right? Every business is going to, if they're going to compete on verifiable proofs of the great work that they're doing, are going to need a trust architect in their community. And so our PIX sort of ambitions are to build a community of hundreds of thousands of trust architects that help organizations outcompete on the great work that they do.
So from a, I guess from a technical angle, then how does this work? Are you talking about, and you mentioned blockchain before, is this something that's in blockchain or how is this?
No blockchain. It's so there's no centralized architecture. So the two sort of technical pieces that sort of allow this to hang together are verifiable credentials and distributed identifiers. And so verifiable credentials are basically using, and I mean, I'm going to dumb this down quite a lot, but basically putting a data packet in an envelope where you use your private key to sign the envelope so that in the data inside the envelope, you know, came from the person who said it, who said it came from, right? So similar to...
Sounds like PGP.
Similar, it's along that, those veins for
okay.
So PGP is for email primarily.
Yeah, but it sounds like similar type of a setup.
Similar conceptual model. Yeah. So verifiable credentials provides a similar kind of model, so you know for sure where the data came from. Distributed identifiers are basically how you know you can trust that private key, basically, right? There's just so those are the two basic components that this gets built on. Inside of these credentials, we're sort of articulating a B2B digital product passport. And that passport will include the product information that describes the product features, what I bought, but also its potential ESG credentials, right? What its carbon load is, how many slaves I use to produce the good. Just kidding, not that one. But
well, I mean, you joke, but this actually happens sadly in the world.
Well, no, it actually the certification that I validated that my supply chain doesn't have slaves is actually a credential people are very much looking for when they're buying goods from suppliers, right?
That's awesome.
And what kind of governance tools do I have in place? And so basically with every product that we're selling, we attach our digital product passport with all sorts of additional credentials that sort of build out that story we want to tell about our product. And some of the data will include in that product passport will be ambit claims. So I'll just say, hey, this is product SKU, blah, 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 1, 2, 3, 4. It's stuff that only I know. And then there will be other claims where there will be a third party verification, right? So carbon load, for example, in order for me to prove to the European Union that this good has a certain product load, they're going to require a third party verification. They're not going to take my word for it. And so attaching that third-party verification to my product passport means that I have confidence that that passport is what I said it was. And a lot of these things already exist. We're just providing a very consistent way of sharing that information at that point of transaction.
Yeah.
And that becomes really critical that it's done consistently because – We already share data. Like I could send you an email about the product you just bought and you're going to go, great, I have an email now. It's in with all the rest of my emails. And the other thing about verifiable credentials that's important is that they come with schema. So they're immediately understandable by a consumer of the data and the product. Not a end consumer, but a business consumer, like a technical consumer. And so what we anticipate is that in our supply chains, we're not going to accept products into our businesses if they don't come with verifiable proof of the claims they're making. Because if I don't have verifiable proofs, I can't make verifiable proofs about the products I'm shipping to my customers. And so we create this sort of virtuous cycle of including data each step of the supply chain that has verifiability as well as understandability so that I can make assertions and assessments about the value of my goods.
How extensible is this to other things like safety and compliance or even AI models?
Completely extensible. So one of the projects that I'm working on is pitching for, it's not active at the minute, but is thinking about large language models and sort of the prompt engineering and the composability of that. Everybody sort of goes, oh, large language models are a black box. But actually, you can kind of think about the question you send to it and the answer you get as a supply chain. Mm-hmm. And you can think about the inputs to that supply chain of sort of the large language model and its version, the vector database that sits next to it, all the components are inputs to that supply chain. And the request is your sort of the response is the product. The request is the demand. Like, you can kind of sort of build a supply chain model of a large language model. And one of the things we're exploring is how do you provide assertions and explainability about the supply chain of a large language model response so that you can understand its veracity and its relevance to the use case and scenario you're doing it, mm-hmm. You're using it for. And so an example in that regard, so just to put a little bit of a wrapper around that, mm-hmm. is you can imagine a large language model providing health insurance advice. So not health advice, but health insurance advice, right? Like, here's how you navigate in the US your health insurance environment. And you can imagine, and actually be willing to bet there's probably a dozen startups absolutely targeting this right now. And what you, dozens probably.
It's a big market. Yes, I would think so. I would hope so.
Yep. So you might use ChatGPT behind the scenes, but one of the first things you'll do from a prompt engineering perspective is you're going to put a filter at the front of that that sort of large language model chat experience, which says, I only answer questions about health insurance. So if you ask a question about health advice, hey, I'm sick and I'm puking on my toilet, it goes, I'm sorry, I don't answer questions about health. I only answer questions about health insurance. That becomes the first element of the supply chain, because when you get to the end and the chatbot says, you're puking over the toilet, maybe you should just go to bed for 3 days and call me in the morning type of thing, that's a false positive, right? You don't want your health insurance advice chatbot saying, providing health advice. If it has done that, that's a false outcome for your product. You want to have explainability. And so you can sort of see all the filters, all the prompts, the prompt engineering activities that sit through that process and go, where did our prompt engineering fail us so that we gave an answer that is not in spec for our product? And so that explainability becomes really important and valuable to leveraging these large language models. And so it might be that your ChatGPT service sort of navigated around all your controls, in which case you go, well, we can't use ChatGPT anymore. We've got to go find a different one. Or maybe your controls didn't capture a specific scenario and you expand the feature, the prompt engineering component that limited that response and sent it back to the large language model, you expand its scope so that it prevents that in the future. And so that we provide sort of that verifiable credential along the way. Each step of that that sort of large language model supply chain becomes verifiable and explainable, and that becomes really powerful in terms of product management and resolution of issues for an engineering team or a product team. I think I didn't quite nail that explanation.
Well, there's also the inputs that go into it, right? So I know part of the EU AI Act is making sure that if there's a copyright request, that you're able to trace those things too, the inputs into the models.
Yeah, so inputs into the large language model itself become an important part of that. And one of the features of our verification model is you're not going to share the full data set of all the data you trained your large language model, but you could potentially provide a hash of that full data set.
Yeah.
So that it's auditable. So that the auditor comes in and says, okay, show me the data set you trained this model on. I've got this hash that you used and you shared publicly, not your data, but the hash of the data. So now as an auditor, I want to run the hash algorithm across that data set and see the same result.
Yep.
And then the auditor then can check the whole thing at the appropriate level of granularity and go, well, you've got this pile over here that's not copyrighted. Mm-hmm. or has copyright infringement, you need to fix it and rerun your model.
Yep.
So it creates that sort of the verifiability isn't necessarily I have to share all the data about everything that I'm doing. But I have the opportunity to share a proof so that if it does get audited in the future, I'm confident that that provides confidence to your consumer that if we do need to audit them in the future, that that audit can occur with rigor.
Is there a notion of carbon output as it relates to training models? Have you thought that far about that yet?
So again, one of the things, if we sort of think about just sort of the general case and we go back to the European Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism.
Yeah.
If I'm ChatGPT and I've trained my model in the US or in a low-cost carbon ecosystem, then as I'm selling ChatGPT services into the European Union, I will be subject to that carbon border adjustment mechanism.
Okay. So works for digital products as well as physical.
So I don't know that the legislation actually applies to digital products at this point, but my view is if it doesn't yet, it will shortly.
Yeah. I mean, you see how much carbon these things use when you're training them. Yep. It's significant.
Yep.
I mean, yeah.
And the carbon cost of our digital ecosystem is pretty invisible to us today. But again, that this technique provides the mechanism of sharing that data in a meaningful way.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a lot of ramifications of what you're describing, and I think it's the ESG's thing's interesting. It's cool. I mean, the other day I was talking with a friend of mine who he runs safety and compliance for a very large e-commerce company. I'm not going to name names. You would know who they are. But he has to go through, so his whole thing is going through reams and reams of PDFs, documentation, lab results, so that he can make sure that the products being sold in this platform are free of harmful or illegal materials. And it seems like something like this would definitely streamline that. Because right now, guys having to either read these physically or like these are millions of pages, by the way. So you're not going to read them. You're going to put them through a ML model and scoop them up. So
yeah,
there's a better standard for this stuff that would make it a lot easier because I can just pick up, okay, this, you know.
Yeah. So this is a better standard for this stuff. And because what this ultimately comes down to is that burden should really exist with the producer of the product. Mm-hmm. Because if they're able to consistently share that data in a way that a safety and compliance executive can read, quote unquote read, right? Again, won't read all of them.
Read it into a computer, but
that's right. Like, and they can then make really robust decisions on robust inputs, right? Like, so right now, reading millions of PDF documents is going to provide inconsistent results because I don't care how good his ML algorithms are. It's going to be a mess. so he will be investing in sort of that the majority of his cost from a compliance and safety perspective is on where those holes in his machine learning algorithms are. And they'll be all over the place, right? Because the PDFs will be provided in very different formats. Mm-hmm. And so basically, this is a standard way to provide that information from his suppliers so that he can consistently evaluate that information and manage his safety and compliance needs.
Dope. Yeah.
And so when we talk about sort of a trust architecture inside of businesses, that's the problem space we're describing for sure.
Yeah, it seems like it. What's that?
His problem space is exactly what we see as one of our major markets for the startup.
Yeah, it's a problem. This guy's pulling his hair out and he doesn't have a lot of it left. So it's like, well,
it's just a messy ecosystem, right? Like we've kind of, we didn't really have the sort of global tools to address this as our sort of digital ecosystem has evolved, mm-hmm. and sort of the global supply chain has evolved. The early examples of this, though, are Edifact. So Walmart for a long, like, so part of Walmart's ability to manage its supply chain is that all of its suppliers have to share their data with Edifact data. They really pioneered that. And basically, they're able to order from their suppliers based on their stock levels decreasing automatically, right? So they have algorithmic supply, and it's just product information. It's just price, volumes, delivery, those types of things. And so the model, the conceptual model is extend Edifact to be much more comprehensive, to include all of the product features, including ESG, but also not just ESG. It's also consistently providing that the product feature data as well.
Yep. Yo, I've used it was EDI very extensively. It works every
we both have gray hairs. We've been around long enough.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, every major retailer in the U.S. uses it. You're not going to get away from it. And you got to set up your supplier on an EDI if you're going to be working with these companies. That's literally one of the first things you're going to be doing. They're not going to mess with you otherwise. They're not worth their time.
Yep.
So
this is kind of the modern version of that standard.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of that. Yeah. Well, and it works because Walmart, even back in the day, when there was still some fledgling, country store out of Bentonville, Arkansas, I think they realized really quickly the value of data, right? I mean, that's why Sam Walton was able to grow real quickly. The dude was maniacal about this kind of stuff. And EDI was one of the huge early leverages that they had. You know, as they grew, it was kind of like, either get on with the standard or, we ain't working with you.
Yeah.
And you don't have much of a choice.
That's the market access description, right? You didn't have access to the Walmart stores, to those, all the consumers that were coming into Walmart stores, unless you complied with the EDI standard.
Yeah.
And so we anticipate this approach being similar.
Yeah. That's interesting. But it's a decentralized thing, though, too. I mean, EDI is one of these things where it is a standard, but it's also it's a bit of a racket. I mean, there's a lot of companies that make a lot of money off of EDI, and this is how any standard goes, I guess. But how do you prevent that, actually? How do you prevent that with what you're describing with trust architecture, like from it becoming a hellscape of consultants and vendors in the space? Or is that fine?
Well, so consultants and vendors make money where there's market inefficiencies and there's opportunities. Becoming an EDI expert is a non-trivial thing, right? Like, you and I are kind of in the weeds here, but it's because we have experience doing the real work of commerce, right? There will be some of that kind of racket we see, but our view and part of our goal is to build a community of hundreds of thousands of trust architects so that there's lots of optionality for organizations as they make this transition. And our startup's goal is to build the tools that those trust architects use, right? So we want to help them implement this type of a protocol faster, more effectively, easier over time. That's sort of our commercialization angle on this.
Sense.
But ultimately, our view is every organization is going to implement the standard on their own, right? They might I'd imagine Walmart will build this in their in-house by their teams. But we also think big vendors are going to bolt this on. So when I ship an invoice to my customer, I'll attach the credentials that prove its carbon load. Mm-hmm. Because I would imagine we're part of the ERP ecosystem pretty heavily. And that becomes a way of people just bolting this into their existing ecosystem, and the existing ecosystem of you called it sort of a hellscape of consultants and vendors. Well, organizations globally have invested heavily in this hellscape, and so we need to activate on top of that. Otherwise, it doesn't move fast enough.
Well, there's a lot of moving parts to this, especially when you're, coming out of the gate saying, oh, it's going to be a global standard. It's like, well, this isn't an Australian standard. It's like, but
no, this is a global standard. We do have some proofs and projects where we've demonstrated this in Australia. We're doing stuff with Canada and the US, like, and so we're seeing quite a lot of sort of global adoption around the world. And we talked a lot about Europe today in terms of sort of the regulatory stakes that sort of are potentially going to move this faster. But we're seeing quite a lot of adoption, particularly around the border and the tariff sort of side of things. Like, how do you facilitate trade while implementing pretty complex oversight rules? Like, there's a tension there, and this becomes a way of big managing one. That tension.
Big one. Interesting. Anything else? I mean, this we covered a lot of ground. I think broad and a bit in the weeds like this. And there's a lot to unpack. I mean, you're talking about it kind of changing a lot of facets of global trade. Twisted was saving the world at the same time. So, not a light topic.
and really activating people to collaborate on both meeting the needs of their organization and their communities while also aligning around some of the big existential issues we're facing. Like that's kind of what's exciting about this. I guess the only other thing I kind of mention is on the sort of how this applies to sort of data engineering and sort of the core of what we do. And so part of my view on this is data supply chains have similar, we talked a little bit about large language supply chains, but I can imagine data supply chains having similar verifiability. And so I when we think about data contracts and sort of that kind of evolution in data product ecosystems, you can kind of start thinking about, hey, when I deliver a data product, I might want to share verifiable information about the sources it came from, the cybersecurity protections it has in place, the frequency it occurs, its relevant, its currency. All of those kinds of things can be part of a credential that goes with the data product, so that I know when I'm making decisions on this data product that it's robust and certified. And importantly, if I'm making assertions to my customers and charging them a premium based on the data pipelines that exist within my organization, I can have confidence in that as well, so that my customers can have confidence. So I see an opportunity potentially for our data engineering community to kind of lean on this standard and build that out as well.
I think the data community needs all the help it can get in this area. So,
yeah, and so the it's a big part of kind of what we've figured out at BizCubed is getting that consistent operational data engineering ecosystem right adds a lot of value. And then if we can add some standards on top, that means that our customers can reflect that value. And so that's kind of the big thing that we're focused on.
In fact, I think this is one of the cornerstones of making it work. It's one thing to have a standard, but what are you going to do? Have somebody manually enter all this crap into a, right? I mean, I know you well enough. You're good at playing like 5D chess at this stuff. I know you've already thought about this, so, you know, but it has to be automated.
Yeah. And actually I mentioned that sort of the verifiable credentials come with schema.
Yeah.
And so I actually anticipate a lot of ESG reporting, a lot of ESG analysis inside of organizations is automated. Like, you can kind of imagine communities and ecosystems of saying, all right, we're going to report on carbon inside of a big corporate. Well, if we've got all of the raw materials coming in a consistent format, you can do quite a lot of pretty powerful analysis, create pretty interesting data products, all sort of automated and simplified. That becomes pretty, pretty compelling to some of these big organizations. I think we're a couple of years away from that, but that's sort of the technical implementation accelerators I anticipate coming.
That's amazing. Well, Zach, it's been good having you on the show, man.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Anytime. I always like talking to you. We'll have to go on a hike. I think I'll be in Australia later this year. So
coming back for
round three.
Fantastic. Yeah. It'll be good to see you. Yeah, definitely.
This is what I've been told. So we'll find out.
No, it's a good little conference. Peter does an amazing job.
Yeah. I think hopefully you might be able to give a talk in this stuff too. I think it'd be pretty awesome. So, but yeah, I think what you're working on is really cool. It's good to see it finally get some traction. I know that, you know, you have a lot of complexities. You're dealing with, the UN and, I don't know, we'll start with that one.
But there's lots of moving parts, and one of the things I kind of think about is, as we start to get the standard started and as people are starting to adopt it, is we're kind of like selling the first fax machine.
Yep.
Because you need both the supplier and the customer to both sort of say, hey, this is a good idea. And it's hard to get started, but we're getting there, and we're starting to see some pretty exciting projects and traction happening, and it's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Well, awesome. Well, we'll see you soon.
See you soon.
All right.
Thanks, Joe.